Discovering Meaning. This is the second tape in the four-part Birthquake series. The first tape of the Birthquake series, The Journey, confronts those painful experiences that we encounter in our lives, addresses the pain and uncertainty of the quake, and explores the opportunities for emotional, physical, and spiritual growth that a birthquake offers. Embracing the Spirit, Tape 3, addresses the meaning, magic, and mystery that confronts those who seek to awaken and reclaim their spirituality. The Mind-Body Dance, the final tape in the series, explores the unity of our physical, emotional, and spiritual selves, offering valuable insights and tools for creating lifestyles that foster health and well-being. Embracing the Spirit, the Mind-Body Dance, and the Journey are also available. In order to achieve maximum benefits from Birthquake, we recommend that you take your time, pausing periodically to reflect upon your own thoughts and experiences. You'll find that the series is as much about you as it is about anybody. At the end of each section, you'll be asked a series of questions. We suggest that you answer each of them in writing. Take your time. In doing so, you'll find that you're discovering a tremendous amount about yourself. We also suggest that you keep a journal while completing the Birthquake series. You can listen to the tapes by yourself, with a partner, or within a group setting. All accounts of clients are disguised to protect their privacy. In some cases, the portraits presented are composites. In others, identifying biographical details have either been omitted or changed. I hope you enjoy Discovering Meaning, read and written by Dr. Tammy Byram Fowles.
Birthquake, Discovering Meaning, Part 1. Virginia's Journey. In a small coastal village in eastern Maine, there lives a woman who is as at peace with her life as anyone I've ever met. She's slender and delicately boned, with innocent eyes and long gray hair. Her home is a small weathered gray cottage with big windows that look out over the Atlantic Ocean. I see her now in my mind's eye. Standing in her sunlit kitchen, she's just taken molasses muffins out of the oven, and the water is warming on the old stove for tea. Music's playing softly in the background. There are wildflowers on the table and potted herbs on the sideboard beside the tomatoes she's picked from her garden. From the kitchen, I can see the book-lined walls of her sitting room and her old dog snoozing on the faded oriental rug. There are sculptures scattered here and there of whales and dolphins, of the wolf and coyote, of the eagle and the crow. Hanging plants grace the corners of the room, and a huge yucca tree stretches up towards the skylight. It's a home that contains one human being and a multitude of other living things. It's a place that once entered becomes difficult to leave. She first came to coastal Maine in her early 40s, when her hair was deep brown and her shoulders stooped. She's remained here walking straight and tall for the past 22 years. She felt defeated when she first arrived. She'd lost her only child to a fatal automobile accident, her breasts to cancer, and her husband 4 years later to another woman. She confided that she'd come here to die and had learned instead how to live. When she first arrived, she hadn't slept a whole night through since the death of her daughter. She would pace the floors, watch television, and read until 2 or 3 in the morning when her sleeping pills finally took effect. Then she would rest at last until lunchtime. Her life felt meaningless, each day and night just another test of her endurance. I felt like a worthless lump of cells and blood and bone, just wasting space, she remembers. Her only promise of deliverance was the stash of pills that she kept tucked away in her top drawer. She planned to swallow them at summer's end. With all of the violence of her life, she would at least die in a gentle season. Virginia wrote, I would walk on the beach every day. I'd stand in the frigid ocean water and concentrate on the pain in my feet. Eventually they'd go numb and wouldn't hurt anymore. I wondered why there was nothing in the world that would numb my heart. I put on a lot of miles that summer, and I saw how beautiful the world still was. That just made me more bitter at first. How dare it be so beautiful when life could be so ugly? I thought it was a cruel joke that it could be so beautiful and yet so terrible here at the same time. I hated a great deal then. Just about everybody and everything was abhorrent to me. I remember sitting on the rocks one day, and along came a mother with a small child. The little girl was so precious. She reminded me of my daughter. She was dancing around and around and talking a mile a minute. Her mother seemed to be distracted and wasn't really paying attention. There it was, the bitterness again. I resented this woman, who had this beautiful child, and had the indecency to ignore her. I was very quick to judge back then. Anyway, I watched the little girl playing and I began to cry and cry. My eyes were running and my nose was running, and there I sat. I was a little surprised. I thought I'd used up all my tears years ago. I hadn't wept in years. Thought I was all dried up and out. Here they were, though, and they began to feel good. I just let them come, and they came and came. I started meeting people. I didn't really want to, because I still hated everybody. These villagers are an interesting lot, though. Awfully hard to hate. They're plain and simple talking people, and they just sort of reel you in without even seeming to pull at your line. I started to receive invitations to this and that, and finally I accepted one to attend a potluck supper. I found myself laughing for the first time in years at a man who seemed to love to make fun of himself. Maybe it was the mean streak I still had, laughing at him, but I don't think so. I think I was charmed by his attitude. He made so many of his trials seem humorous. I went to church the following Sunday. I sat there and waited to get angry as I heard this fat man with soft hands talking about God. What did he know of heaven or of hell? And yet I didn't get mad. I started to feel kind of peaceful as I listened to him. He spoke of Ruth. Now, I knew very little about the Bible, and this was the first time I'd heard about Ruth. Ruth had suffered greatly. She'd lost her husband and left behind her homeland. She was poor and worked very hard gathering fallen grain in the fields of Bethlehem to feed herself and her mother-in-law. She was a young woman with a very strong faith, for which she was rewarded. I had no faith and no rewards. I longed to believe in the goodness and existence of God, but how could I? What kind of a God would allow such terrible things to happen? It seemed simpler to accept that there was no God. Still, I kept going to church, not because I believed. I just liked to listen to the stories that were told in such a gentle voice by the minister. I liked the singing, too. Most of all, I appreciated the peacefulness I felt there. I began to read the Bible and other spiritual works. I found so many of them to be filled with wisdom. I didn't like the Old Testament. I still don't. Too much violence and punishment for my taste, but I loved the Psalms and the Songs of Solomon. I found great comfort in the teachings of the Buddha, too. I began to meditate and to chant. Summer had led to fall, and I was still here, my pills safely hidden away. I still planned to use them, but I wasn't in such a hurry. I lived most of my life in the Southwest, where the changing of seasons is a very subtle thing compared to the transformation that takes place in the Northeast. I told myself that I would live to watch the seasons unfold before departing from this earth. Knowing I would die soon enough, and when I chose, brought me some comfort. It also inspired me to look very closely at things I had been oblivious to for so long. I watched the heavy snowfalls for the first time, believing that this would also be my last, as I would not be here to see them the next winter. I'd always had such beautiful and elegant clothes. I'd been raised in an upper-middle-class family where appearances were of the utmost importance. I cast them off in exchange for the comfort and warmth of wool, flannel, and cotton. I began to move about in the snow more easily now and found my blood invigorated by the cold. My body grew stronger as I shoveled snow. I began sleeping deeply and well at night and was able to throw my sleeping pills away. Not my deadly stash, though. I met a very bossy woman who insisted that I help her with her various humanitarian projects. She taught me to knit for the poor children as we sat in her delicious-smelling kitchen, surrounded often by her own grandbabies. She scolded me into accompanying her to the nursing home where she read and ran errands for the elderly. She arrived one day at my home armed with a mountain of wrapping paper and demanded that I help her wrap gifts for the needy. I usually felt angry and invaded by her. Whenever I could, I pretended at first not to be home when she came calling. One day I lost my temper and called her a busybody and stormed out of the house. A few days later she was back in my dooryard. When I opened my door, she plopped down at the table, told me to make her a cup of coffee, and behaved as if nothing had happened. We never did speak of my temper tantrum in all of our years together. We became the best of friends, and it was during that first year that she rooted herself into my heart that I began to come alive. I absorbed the blessings that came from serving others, just as my skin had gratefully absorbed the healing bag of balm I had been given by my friend. I began to rise early in the morning. All of a sudden, I had much to do in this life. I watched the sun rise, feeling privileged and imagining myself to be one of the first to see it appear, as a resident now in this northern land of the rising sun. I found God here. I don't know what his or her name is, and I don't really care. I only know that there is a magnificent presence in our universe, and in the next one, and the next after that. My life has a purpose now. It's to serve and to experience pleasure. It's to grow, and to learn, and to rest, and to work, and to play. Each day is a gift to me, and I enjoy them all, some certainly less than others. I recall a verse I read somewhere. It says, two men look out through the same bars. One sees mud, and the other stars. I choose to gaze at the stars now, and I see them everywhere, not only in the darkness, but in the daylight, too. I threw out the pills that I was going to use to do myself in long ago. They had turned all powdery anyway. I will live as long and as well as I am permitted to, and I will be thankful for every moment I am on this earth. I carry this woman in my heart wherever I go now. She offers me great comfort and hope. I would dearly love to possess the wisdom, strength, and peace that she's acquired during her lifetime. We walked, she and I, on the beach 3 summers ago. I felt such wonder and contentment at her side. When it was time for me to return home, I glanced down and noticed how our footprints had converged in the sand. I hold that image within me still, of our 2 separate sets of footprints united for all time in my memory. The turning. As baby boomers progress into middle age, many of us find ourselves struggling with the fact that we're not kids anymore. What makes growing older particularly difficult for my generation is quite likely the environment in which we came of age. Gail Shea reports in New Passages, Mapping Your Life Across Time, that those born between the ages of 1946 and 1956 experienced the benefits of having had the most privileged and extended period of adolescence of any other generation in history. Those of us born between the years 1956 and 1965 hold the dubious honor of being part of that distinctive class of Americans labeled the Me Generation. We're said to have wanted everything, fame, fortune, adventure, and we expected it now. Our images of middle age consisted of such goodies as thickening waistlines, dentures, and wrinkles. We heard, never trust anyone over 30, and what a drag it is getting old. We, the boomers, were the ones who counted, the ones with the greatest promise. We were going to usher in the brave new world. Is it any wonder that she equipped, who can embrace the larger meaning of life beyond youth when the most important thing in the world is still me? We weren't prepared to become middle-aged. Even the term was somehow offensive. We were the largest, the loudest, and the toughest. We were the first in all kinds of categories. So how could we possibly be downgraded to the middle? Entering midlife with the losses we perceive this stage to entail has a lot of us more than a little disoriented. Confronted with aching backs, bad knees, expensive dental work, new rules, new roles, and the dawning awareness that we too are really going to die, leaves us just a little bit shaken, to say the least. We midlifers, who at one time thought we had most of the answers and were very willing to share them, are now discovering more and more questions. And while we've generally become more sensitive to the needs and pain of others as we've matured, and can congratulate ourselves for having attained a significant degree of wisdom, we must also acknowledge that we're not as gifted as we perhaps once thought we were at handling the heartache of another, and even less uncertain when dealing with our own. Often, we attempt to talk those we care about out of their painful feelings. If, on the other hand, it's we who are suffering, we tend to focus on the unfortunate aspects of our difficult situations, instead of acknowledging the opportunity that troublesome circumstances or feelings may present. We've generally only given lip service to that tired old cliche about making lemons into lemonade. We've never been particularly good at it anyway. We've been graced with a multitude of choices and a significant amount of control over much of our lives for so long that we've come to see these gifts as entitlements. And while midlife offers tremendous benefits, it also confronts us with new and unsettling limits and losses that will inevitably, if they haven't already, cause us to experience some degree of suffering. Because suffering is unavoidable, not because it's good for you, it becomes increasingly important to begin to come to terms with it. The strengthening. When my daughter was around 2 years old and seemingly in perpetual motion whenever her eyes were open, I came down with a very bad case of the flu. My husband was out of town. We'd recently moved to the area, so I hadn't yet established a support system from which I could call upon, and my family lived 5 hours away. I was on my own. I could barely move without the room spinning or needing to vomit. In spite of her mother's incapacitation, my little girl's demands remained constant and her needs immediate. I knew I definitely was not equal to the task, and I was also aware that I had no choice but to do what I didn't believe I could do. I was miserable and felt more than a little self-pity. On the afternoon of the second day of my ordeal, a woman I hardly knew called regarding a meeting I was to attend the following week. She noticed that my voice was weak and shaky and asked with concern if I was all right. I told her I was ill and alone with my daughter and was feeling pretty overwhelmed. Her sympathy was comforting, but it was a single comment she made that left the greatest impact. She said, "Things like this are strengthening." It didn't strike me that she was minimizing my situation, nor that she was offering a quick cliché before abandoning me to my own devices. Instead, I felt that she'd understood, that she herself had been strengthened by a similar experience, and that she truly believed that I would be too. I hung up the phone and painfully began to make lunch for my daughter, who was demanding that I pick her up and play our daily lunch game. Her cries grew louder when I refused to comply, and my nausea seemed to increase with every raised decibel. I began repeating silently over and over, "This is strengthening. This is strengthening." While my body remained unmoved, my spirits gradually began to lift. The next day, while lying on the couch with my daughter, it occurred to me that this had been the first time that we'd simply lain together for an entire day, watching cartoons, telling stories, reading books, and snuggling. I chose to count the blessings of this experience, and to my surprise, I was able to identify more than I would have thought possible. I smiled for the first time in days as I acknowledged that I had indeed been strengthened. In Legacy of the Heart, The Spiritual Advantages of a Painful Childhood, Wayne Muller notes that those who have suffered in childhood while bearing painful scars invariably exhibit exceptional strengths, including remarkable insight, creativity, and a profound inner wisdom. He challenges these individuals not to perceive themselves as broken and damaged, nor to eliminate parts of themselves, but rather to strive to reawaken that which is wise, whole, and strong within them. In working with victims of childhood trauma, he observed that while still haunted by their past, they also developed an acute sensitivity to others, as well as a tendency to seek beauty, love, and peace. Muller wisely observed that, seen through this lens, family sorrow is not only a painful wound to be endured, analyzed, and treated. It may, in fact, become a seed that gives birth to our spiritual healing and awakening. It's been my experience that this is often the case with survivors of childhood trauma. While not all survivors with whom I've worked possess the characteristics Muller so respectfully describes, I'm almost always struck by the strength and depth of these people. Each person has brought to therapy unique skills and abilities developed to a significant degree by the very pain they sought to escape. Muller assures his readers that suffering and pain are not exceptions to the human condition. Instead, they're inevitable threads in the tapestry of life. He cautions us not to become trapped by memories of childhood suffering, consequently allowing the suffering to become the one thing which is the truest about our lives. He also points out that many of us would rather talk about our hurt instead of feel it. He advises that we accept the pain we've endured and identify the lessons it will inevitably teach if we only look and listen, particularly to the wisdom contained within the depths of our own souls. While I don't under any circumstances wish to minimize the pain of another, nor suggest that he or she be grateful for suffering, I do believe that in order to empower another, it's important that the value of all experiences in a person's life be acknowledged. Although there have been many challenges I would have refused to struggle with in my own life had I been given the choice, to deny the value of the message in spite of how painful the lesson or unwelcome the messenger only serves to add insult to injury. if one has no choice but to toil on a particular path, at the very least, claim every available compensation along the way. My friend Victoria phoned the other night. Our friendship has spanned over 15 years, and now since I've moved to South Carolina, must reach over 1,000 miles. I miss her. She's consistently provided me with comfort and inspiration, and I've long admired her commitment to live her values. What she believes in is what she acts on. She calmly witnessed and supported Kevin and myself during our difficult period of transition. It appears that she now may be entering her own. I attempt to reassure her over the telephone. I share with her that while the period before we moved away was difficult, I seriously doubted we would have mobilized ourselves to make the necessary changes in our lives without the pain. It's so often easier to remain in a familiar rut than to leave its security and venture out into the unknown. Suffering has often proven to be a catalyst for growth in my own life. In an attempt to avoid dealing with my childhood agonies, I turned to reading as an escape. It was the discontentment and desire to flee poverty that prompted me to attend my first college class. Later, it was only after my husband and I had separated for 9 months that I braved graduate school. Because I myself had experienced despair, I was able to understand and assist others in dealing with their own. It was the numerous mistakes and contradictions in my own character which helped me not to judge the failings of another. The more often I fell, the less likely I was to look down upon someone else who had lost his or her balance. And it was only after surviving again and again the disappointments in my own life that I came to understand that it's in each of our natures to recover. Healing is a natural process. The wisdom born of pain. From time to time, Kevin reminds me that when he first met me at the age of 15, in an attempt to engage me in conversation, he asked me what I wanted to be when I grew older. I informed him that my goal was to become wise. He was dumbfounded. Who was this person, and who on earth had as a lifelong dream to become wise, he wondered. I did. I still do. And I'm certain that it's been the wisdom born of pain that has carried me the furthest in my pursuit of this goal. The presence of pain saves lives. When my mother was a child, she was playing too close to an open flame. It wasn't until she felt the first stab of pain that she realized that her dress was on fire and cried for help. Had her body failed to register this sensation, she would have quickly become a human torch. Pain tells us when we're in trouble, and hopefully we'll keep getting our attention until we do what we need to do to save ourselves. I'm good at suffering. I think I do it more blatantly than many people I know. I was reading a story to my daughter one morning about a dog named Murphy who died. I began to cry and continued to weep while I read the rest of the book. My daughter thinks I'm strange. It isn't the first time I've burst into tears while reading or watching a movie with her. I was a wreck when she and I saw The Land Before Time together. The suffering of others, even cartoon characters, has always touched me deeply. I've often wondered how I managed to survive as a psychotherapist with such an acute sensitivity to pain. And then again, perhaps it's this sensitivity that contributed more to my success than any skill I acquired during my years of training. I was trained to remain as objective as possible in my work with clients. Crying in their presence was definitely not considered to be of therapeutic value. For years, I'd watched people in terrible agony and not shed a tear. My throat would ache, and my neck and chest muscles would tighten, though. An ancient Chinese belief is that the neck mediates between the thinking mind and the feeling heart. Consequently, when there's difficulty with the neck area, this can often be linked to some kind of withholding or repression of emotional pain. During my early years as a therapist, I constantly had a stiff neck. Eventually, I said to hell with a cool and objective facade that I'd been taught to project. From time to time, though rarely, I began to permit my own tears to join those of my clients. I don't regret a single moment that I've wept with a client. Maybe it's a rationalization, but I believe that in showing my own pain, I help to validate the feelings of another. My tears are saying, "Yes, it's hard. It's terrible. You're right to cry. It hurts so much that I cry too." As I allowed myself to express my feelings more fully to my clients, the aching in my neck eased significantly. While discussing compassion in her book, Living with Chronic Illness, Sherry Register points out that the prefix com in Latin means with. When we experience compassion for another, we feel with them, and may thus transform a solitary and often lonely experience into one that's shared. I, personally, would rather be joined in my pain than be silently observed. I hate suffering, especially my own. I recognize that this may seem like a contradiction to what I've previously maintained regarding the value of suffering, but nevertheless, it's all true for me. I would banish all heartache from the earth if I could, but I can't. No one can. There will always be suffering. And while it can transform, it can also destroy. As a therapist, I've witnessed the destruction that suffering can produce more often than I care to remember. I've also watched strength and wisdom slowly evolve and emerge from the depths of despair. Those times I wish to never forget. Sometimes the metamorphosis from tragedy to triumph is profound. Other times, discomfort may simply lead to a new insight. The smallest insights, however, can sometimes have a very large effect. One simple example of how this can occur may be found in Regina's story. Regina revisits. Regina had been referred to me by a former client several years ago for assistance in dealing with panic attacks. Her attacks involved shortness of breath, heart palpitations, dizziness, hot flashes, and tremendous fear that she was going to die. Regina had been a victim of violence as a child, and her abuse as well as her symptoms were addressed in treatment. Our work together had been successful, and I hadn't seen nor heard from her for at least 3 years. When Regina recontacted me, she informed me that she was beginning to experience anxiety again. While she was able to control her symptoms from developing into a full-blown anxiety attack, she was concerned by the frequency of their reoccurrence. During our first visit, Regina informed me that she had recently married a wonderful man. They'd moved into a spacious new home, and he had an adorable and loving 8-year-old son who visited every other weekend. As Regina continued to update me, it became apparent that her symptoms appeared most often on Friday nights, just before her new stepson arrived, and got worse as the weekend wore on. She explained that she enjoyed his visits very much, and she could not imagine why she was experiencing anxiety. She added that she loved her job and seldom dreaded returning on Monday mornings. Further discussion did not appear to render particularly helpful clues. I decided to do some body work with Regina. I asked her to check in with her body and tell me what she was experiencing. With guidance, she was able to identify that her throat felt tight as well as her chest. I played soothing music, asked her to lie down, worked with her progressively to relax her muscles, and then, with her permission, placed one hand gently over her chest and one on her throat. For several minutes, I held my hands in place and instructed her to patiently wait for a message from her throat and chest. Tears eventually began sliding down her cheeks. She began to grimace and soon was sobbing. When she was able to speak, she informed me that she felt guilty. Her own son was now grown and off to college. She'd given birth to him when she was just 16 and had struggled a great deal when he was growing up. She'd never felt that she really bonded with him. Their relationship was polite but strained, and their contact was limited to brief telephone conversations and occasional visits. She'd grown to love her stepson and felt guilty and sad that she was able to do with him and for him what she had not been able to do for her own child. We explored the many contributing factors which had made it difficult for her while her son was growing up, and acknowledged the tremendous ways in which she had grown over the years. I pointed out that while it was too late to enjoy her son's childhood, it wasn't too late to attempt to build a closer relationship with him. Nor was it wrong to love and enjoy the new little boy in her life. In fact, I observed that in loving her stepson, she might learn how to express her love to her grown son more effectively. We then reviewed the skills she had learned during our previous work together, not only in symptom management, but also in symptom prevention. She agreed to utilize these tools more often than she had during the past year. We scheduled our next appointment for 1 month later, with the understanding that she could contact me for an earlier appointment if the need arose. Regina informed me during our next visit that she'd really thought about what we discussed and remembered a book that she'd read to her stepson some time ago. The book was written to a son from a mother, and contained the message that no matter how much he drove her crazy or how old he got, she would always love him. She went out and purchased a copy for her grown son and included a heartfelt letter of love and apology to him. Shortly after she mailed her offering, she received a phone call from her only biological child. The two had a long and loving talk, and he agreed to meet her halfway the following Saturday between the college and her new home in order to spend the day together. After their meeting, Regina felt that she and her son had made significant progress in healing old wounds, and she felt connected to him once again. She also no longer felt guilty about her relationship with her stepson. Regina reported that she hadn't experienced anxiety symptoms in over 3 weeks and was confident that she could deal with them again if and when they reoccurred. We didn't reschedule, as Regina understood that I was available should she need me in the future. Approximately 6 months later, I received a note from her in the mail stating that she was doing well and had not been troubled by anxiety since her meeting with her son. For Regina, as with most of us, there was a lesson in her pain. By looking at her anxiety and listening to what it might have to share with her, she was able to recognize feelings she had long repressed regarding her relationship with her son. In acknowledging and accepting her feelings of guilt and regret, she was then able to work towards reconciliation. Gabriel Rico was in serious trouble. Chronic anxiety, panic attacks, and physical illness besieged her. Distracted by mothering, writing, teaching, and lecturing, she had successfully repressed much of her pain for years. Little by little, however, her old coping techniques were beginning to fail her. The small rumblings of her quake began to build into an ominous roar, which refused to be silenced. Feeling increasingly anxious and overwhelmed, she retreated to a small cabin in the Sierras. The cabin was surrounded by redwoods and overlooked a stream. It was a beautiful place to rest, to rejuvenate, and to gain much-needed perspective. It was here, with no telephone or car, that Gabriel prepared to face her demons, and they came. Her time in the cabin was often frightening and almost always painful at first. However, as she struggled to stay put, to look and listen and feel, she began to get in touch with the source of her fear and despair. In working through her agony, she utilized the tools of her trade. She wrote. And the more she wrote, the more she understood, and the more empowered she became. Her writing poured out of the deepest and darkest places of her soul, during a time which she later described as my own terrible downward spiral into crisis. It was in coming to terms with her pain that the book Pain and Possibility began to take shape. And so the wisdom born of Rico's pain is thankfully shared with the rest of us. Pain and Possibility is an outstanding book that provides the reader with some of the most effective tools I am aware of in utilizing the written word to discharge, process, and work through pain. Rico writes, "No one is immune to pain, but I know many who let pain fester and take charge of their lives. I know from my own experience that it is possible to discharge that pain and become recharged." Anger is anchor. According to Buddhist teachings, the three primary causes of suffering, in addition to attachment, are anger, ignorance, and greed. I once worked with a couple who came to me requesting that I help them fix their troubled relationship. The problem was that neither of them was willing to change their own behavior. Each expected me to get the other to change. Not surprisingly, therapy failed, although the couple stayed together. Years later, the husband phoned my office and informed me that his wife was gravely ill and was not expected to live much longer. He told me that she'd been asking to see me. I agreed to stop by their home, although I didn't look forward to our meeting, as my own issues regarding death were largely unresolved. She reached out for my hand when I entered her room and began to cry. I embraced her, said a few words in greeting, and then we sat in silence. Eventually, she began to talk. She spoke of many things: her past, her children, her husband, her illness, and her fear. I said very little in spite of the words of reassurance that wanted to come flooding out of my mouth. She needed a compassionate witness, and so I restrained myself and listened loudly. There were many things she confided that day, which I'll always remember. However, there was one observation in particular that I feel is important to share with you here. She told me that as she thought about her life, she realized that she'd spent a great deal of it being angry. While she continued to feel that she'd been treated unfairly by others, she had also concluded that her anger had eaten away at her soul, as effectively as the cancer was now eating away her body. She deeply regretted all that she now felt had been sacrificed to her indignation. "If only I would have let go of all my resentments years ago," she lamented. I never saw her again. Her husband contacted me approximately 3 weeks later and informed me that she died peacefully at home. He calmly informed me of many of the details of her death and then began to cry. I asked him if he was all right, and he replied, "Tammy, do you know what she asked me to do that morning?" "What?" I asked. A voice filled with pain, but also with what I believe was awe, replied, "She asked me to forgive her." Holding on. The Buddha also taught that the more one resists suffering, the more it intensifies. M. Scott Peck, in his best-selling book, The Road Less Traveled, maintained that it's the tendency to avoid problems and emotional suffering which is the primary cause of all mental illness. While I'm not certain that I agree with Peck entirely, I am struck by how true this seems in cases of alcoholism, workaholism, relationship addiction, gambling, and other addictions. In fact, I've often been frustrated with how so many women with whom I've worked stayed stuck in destructive relationships. I watched them suffer day after day because they couldn't tolerate the pain involved in letting go of the dream that they could somehow get their loved one to change. Catherine was one such individual. Catherine met her husband when she was 15. She married him 4 years later, after breaking up and reuniting with him several times. When I met her, she looked older than her 44 years. She was depressed, overweight, and frightened. Her husband's drinking had escalated to the point where his job was in jeopardy. He'd recently completed an inpatient treatment program to address his alcoholism. However, he'd resumed drinking 3 months after his release from the program. He was becoming increasingly ill from the abuse of his body. He was using a great deal of sick time, and once again his behavior was erratic, disruptive, and abusive. Catherine's own physical health was deteriorating. Her blood pressure was alarmingly high. She had colitis and experienced increasingly more severe bouts with migraines. While she worried that her husband's addiction to alcohol would kill him, I was concerned that her addiction to him might eventually destroy her. For several years, she'd attempted to get him to change. She'd participated in Al-Anon, had attended AA with him whenever she could get him to join her, and had been in family counseling, couples counseling, and individual counseling twice before. After 25 years of begging, ignoring, manipulating, cajoling, and seducing, things were only worse. Her children, now grown, were unhappy and bitter. Her finances were precarious, her health poor, and her life seemed to her to be filled with disappointment and futility. She hated her husband, and yet she didn't feel that she could leave him. She tried twice before, only to return. Catherine explained, "I couldn't stand it. It hurt so badly. I couldn't sleep or eat or think straight. I thought about him all of the time. It seemed as though I was damned if I left, damned if I stayed. I decided to stay. It was a lot less scary and less lonely," she explained. "But was it?" My experience had been that those in unhealthy and distancing relationships seemed to be the loneliest of people. When I shared this observation with her, she agreed that she'd been terribly lonely for years, particularly since the children had left. I informed Catherine that I could do nothing to help her with her husband, and that I would work with her only if she agreed that the focus of our work would be on her, not him. She accepted my condition of treatment. Catherine's childhood story was similar to those of other women who had found themselves feeling trapped in unhealthy relationships. She'd been an unhappy child, raised by a depressed mother and an abusive alcoholic father. She dreamed of the day that a handsome prince would carry her away, and they'd finally live happily ever after. Tragically, her adult life had come to closely mirror the life she tried to escape. While the details had changed, she had remained depressed, disappointed, frightened, and still waiting for her happy ending. As a child, she'd relied upon a rich imagination to help her avoid dealing with her painful feelings. As an adult, she'd focused on working on her husband's potential to someday become her prince. Just as in her childhood, she was left with only her fantasies to hold on to. Catherine didn't want to revisit her childhood, and I didn't blame her. It had been painful then. It was still too painful now. The further we looked into her life, the greater our awareness became of how deep her pain was, and had always been. It was far safer to worry about her husband than to feel her anger, her sadness, her emptiness, her shame. Just when her depression threatened to deepen, her husband would rescue her by creating another crisis to which she would have to attend. And so it went. Catherine would peer over and into the deep well of her misery, and then she'd quickly retreat, running the other way in order to put out another of her husband's fires. She would run around and around and around. Still, running while exhausting can be a lot less scary than standing still. To leave her husband, she would have to abandon her dreams. She'd have to accept that all of her years of agony had failed to produce her happy ending. The pain of facing this bitter reality appeared to be more than she could endure. To suffer a little every single day, but have hope that it might all eventually be worth it, seemed much more appealing than to suffer tremendously. And for what? To save her life. For years, she'd stayed with her husband and in therapy with me. First, I hoped that she'd leave him. Later, I began to secretly wish that she'd at least leave me in peace. And then her oldest son attempted suicide. She spent agonizing days and nights at the hospital, waiting to see if he would live, and then waiting to know if he'd sustain permanent brain damage. For months, she was caught up in this terrible aftermath. Her quake. As her son began to recover, she too finally became ready to work through her own denial. Just as she'd urged him to fight for his life, she was now prepared to reclaim her own, and step, sometimes painful, sometimes triumphant step, that's exactly what she did. I ran into Catherine at the grocery store a few years ago. She looked wonderful. She divorced her husband about 8 months before finishing her work with me. She'd informed me that she remained single and lived in a delightfully cozy apartment close by her son and daughter-in-law. She had strengthened her ties to old friends, as well as establishing new relationships. She was painting again. She'd loved to paint as a young girl, and had joined forces with a group of women who supported each other's efforts to build spirituality into their everyday lives. We chatted and laughed up and down the aisles of Shop and Save and stood in line together to check out. As she completed her transaction and was closing her purse preparing to leave, I asked quietly, "Whatever happened to Happily Ever After?" She smiled impishly and said, "It's here."
This concludes Side 1 of Discovering Meaning.